Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com. I'm HRN's Communication Director, Kat Johnson, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're exploring the future of eating animals, and we're going beyond typical meat sources.
If you look at the length of human history, we've been eating insects a lot longer than we haven't been in the United States and Western Europe.
We're looking at unusual ways to purchase meat.
People are like, really? Why would I want to buy that out of a machine?
And we introduce you to Frank Rees, a poultry farmer whose traditional farming methods are featured in a new documentary.
I'm a fourth generation farmer in Kansas, and I focus basically all on standard bred poultry and have my whole life.
He's kind of the last one standing with these rarefied breeds that are so important for if we're going to eat chicken and turkey into the future. He's essential. He's a national treasure.
Listen to Meat and Three this week to better understand the history and the future of meat. Available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. This is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is Yawande Komolafi, a chef, recipe developer, and food stylist based in Brooklyn. Yawande grew up in Lagos, Nigeria, and has worked in kitchens across the country, including Momofuku Milk Bar in Manhattan. She's developed and tested hundreds of recipes for the James Beard Foundation, Bon Appetit, Savour, and Styled Food for the New York Times, Food 52, Munchies, and more. Yawande is also the creator of My Immigrant Food Is, a dinner series that inspires conversations that delve into the idea of home being centered around food, migration, and adaptation. Yawande.
Hi.
Welcome to A Hungry Society.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
This has been in the works for so long.
January?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Yawande and I met at her dinner series, My Immigrant Food Is. And it was just like this beautiful night of delicious food and really interesting people and conversations about food, but mostly what it means to be American.
And be an immigrant in America.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So can you talk a little bit more about your dinner series?
Of course. So it all started in the fall of 2016. I was looking to explore my identity more. I was born in Berlin, moved back to Nigeria when I was one or two, grew up in Nigeria till I was about 16, and moved to the United States for college. I've lived in the U.S. for about 20 years, and in that time, I went to college, did that whole thing, went to culinary art school, and now I find myself doing recipe development, testing, food styling. But in that time, I had never really explored what it meant to be Nigerian through food. I'd cooked in pastry kitchens, I'd cooked all kinds of other different cuisines, but I never really cooked Nigerian food. And so in the fall of 2016, I decided to turn that food lens on myself. And I was really curious about questions like, what does it mean to be Nigerian? And, to have lived here in the United States for about 20 years. And what does it mean to cook the food from my home, but be so far away from my home? Mm-hmm. And so I was really trying to understand my process, my immigrant process. And the way I did that was by cooking Nigerian food and sharing it with people that came to my home to eat it. And so that's essentially what the dinner series was based on, an exploration of myself.
Mm-hmm. And one of the most fun parts of the dinner series is that in the middle of each table, there are these discussion questions.
Yes.
You and your fellow dinner guests can talk about. Can you say some of those questions?
Of course, I actually brought some with me, so I'm going to read. This is from the June dinner, and it asks, "Where did you grow up? Describe your favorite meal from childhood. How did it look, smell, taste? What emotions came up for you?" And so we're really just looking to engage the dinner guest. The dinners are held in my home. It's pretty intimate. It's pretty small. And so we're looking to engage the guests that this is a dinner that's not just about the food, but it's also about a conversation that we want to have amongst ourselves. Like, we're cooking the food that we grew up eating. Like, what's the food you grew up eating? What's the food, like, what has been, if you have an immigrant story, like, share it with us. We want to know in your own voice. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important part of the dinner series. Is that I collaborate with other women who have interesting or who are also from immigrant backgrounds, and we tell our stories in our own voice, mm-hmm. which is a really important part for me, to be able to, like, tell my story in my own voice, not someone else telling my story for me. And so the dinners have served as a platform to do that.
Yeah, the dinner that I went to, it was you and Yemi.
Yemi, yes.
Friend of the show. Shout out to her if she's listening.
Oco Farms.
Oco Farms, yeah, is amazing. Mm-hmm. And it was so great. Like, the food was so vibrant and interesting and featured ingredients from the farm.
Yes, yes.
And can you talk about some of the dishes that you've made? Like, do you have any personal favorites that you've made?
Favorites is a hard one for me. It's like, I like food so much, it's hard to pick one. So the dinners have evolved into a thing that Yemi and I do together, actually. And she grows very specific vegetables. She grows fish. She grows herbs that we use in the dinner series. So she grows very specifically for the dinner series. And I just love that I can call her and say, I have a dinner coming up in 4 weeks. Like, can we grow some cilantro? Can we grow some chives? Can we grow some spinach? You know, whatever she could do. But I love that relationship with her, that we're able to I think, show the cycle of food, because mm-hmm. that's another important part of the dinners, is like, highlighting the cycle of food. Like, your food comes from somewhere, and
right.
and this is the person who grew it, you know. So yeah, that's another layer of story that we're trying to tell at the dinners.
Yeah, you're cooking, and even like, kind of your social media presence, you travel quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
How do your travels influence, like, when you come back and you do these dinners, like, how do they play together?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think also with the dinners, I've tried to, so it's one thing to cook Nigerian food in the way that my mom cooks it, or my grandmother cooked it, or my aunties cook it, using the same ingredients that they do. But I think it's also a really interesting story to use the ingredients that grow around me, and use the things that are available to me in my immediate environment. And so traveling has helped me see that everyone kind of cooks that way. Like, people are very inspired by their environment, and it shows up in their cooking, you know, what grows around them. So, like, the distance from food isn't so great. Like, I was recently in Nigeria in March, and I found that, like, at the markets, you could buy live animals.
Like, what kinds of animals?
Like, you could buy a goat or a chicken, and it was amazing to me, you know? Like, I'm not going to the store and getting, like, a chicken breast. It's like, what happened to the rest of the chicken, you know?
Right.
And so there's, there's, like, this relationship with food where you're so close to it, and you know exactly what it is. There's not a distance. And so I think traveling has inspired me to create that relationship in my dinners, mm-hmm. where there's a closeness to the food that you're eating. Like, I want people to know where what they're putting in their bodies is coming from, essentially. Right. And of course, it also just exposes me to, like, new flavors, new cuisines, like, new taste. And I bring a little bit of that back to Brooklyn with me, and it shows up on the dinner plate.
That would be a really interesting dinner if you had the whole animal.
Oh my God, that would be amazing.
This is your goat that you're gonna have for dinner.
Like, here's a goat, let's parade it around the room. Like, get to know the goat.
Right, you know? That would be like, wow. Just
The last couple of dinners I did whole fish and just served it whole, mm-hmm. instead of like filleting it and trying to make it look all like, I don't know what the word is, because I think whole fish is pretty, but mm-hmm. fillets are also, you know, there's a beauty to the fillet as well. But yes, I've been serving whole fish on a platter. It's just like, this mm-hmm. is it. Like, this is what it looks like, you yeah. know, like, get to know it.
I personally love whole fish. Like, I like picking into the head and eating the cheeks and that. But some people get squeamish about it.
It's okay to be squeamish, but still do it. You know?
Right. That's where the good stuff is.
Yeah, totally.
So another part of your background is working in restaurants. So how did you go from restaurant work to food styling and recipe development?
It was a long journey. So I moved here to the United States. I went to college. I thought that I wanted to be a food scientist. My mom's a food scientist, and I had always been inspired by her work. And so, like, I knew I wanted to be in food. So I went to college, tried to do biochemistry. I hated chemistry. Ended up with, like, a degree in psychology and biology. So I had a science background. I immediately enrolled in culinary arts school and did both a pastry program and a culinary arts program, and worked in restaurants. I worked in restaurants for about 15 years. Mm. Towards the end of that 15 years, I discovered recipe testing, and by interning at the test kitchen at Sever. And for a while, I had like one leg in restaurants and one leg in test kitchens. Like, I knew that recipe testing spoke to me, to like that science part of my brain, and it felt like I was in a lab again, but I was with food, which I loved. And so I eventually transitioned out of restaurants into test kitchens and just freelanced in test kitchens. I worked at a few test kitchens. I moved to Birmingham and worked with Southern Living, and you know, so I did that for a while, and now I do it on my own. I run an independent test kitchen, essentially, where I work primarily on cookbooks and recipe testing for, like, publications.
You're still a food scientist in a way.
In a way, yeah. You know, it's in this really comical way, I do what my mom did. You know? Like, I ended up, like, doing exactly what my mom did. My mom did recipe testing and recipe development, and that's what I do now, you know? So it just took me a little longer.
Yeah, to find your way back to doing
what I originally wanted to do, you know.
Right. So you wrote this piece in December for Munchies.
Yes.
That was really, really interesting, and a perspective that I think we don't hear enough about being an undocumented restaurant worker. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read a piece of it because this is like my favorite. Restaurants reflect who we are and what we strive to be. I believe the restaurant industry is one place where the immigrant story can be articulated. The narratives we encounter are too often focused on the work being done, the role being filled, a myopic story influenced by a culture of aggression and white male privilege. The powerful restaurateur, the brilliant head chef, the creative genius who has created a space to be an asshole, the fetishized bartender in his uniform, cheapens the depth and the complexity of everyone's story, theirs included, as well as the story of the establishment they represent.
Yes.
Awesome. Can you talk a little bit about that and, like, the whole piece in general?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, as with any story, it starts with, like, a human story. Mm-hmm. And a human story is nuanced. It's diverse. It's dynamic. And I feel that the story that we hear too often about the restaurants that do get published and the restaurants that do get highlighted are never about what's really in those restaurants. It's about, like, a slice of that restaurant. Mm-hmm. But restaurants require teamwork. And so that one chef that you see is not the only person that makes that restaurant. And, you know, having worked in restaurants for about 15 years, I worked with, like, so many wonderful people who, you know, as including myself, were undocumented. And you never hear that story. Like, I think that I could have gotten so much from hearing a story of, like, a restaurant chef who was also undocumented. Like, people are talking about it now, but what about the last 15 years, you know? Mm-hmm. And so in that piece, I was trying to say and trying to tell the story of, like, the people that you never hear about in restaurants who exist. You know, there's something so powerful in telling the true story and the real story, because in that story, people can realize that they do exist and they do mean something. Mm-hmm. And so that's what that piece was about. But thank you for reading that.
No problem. And there's another part of the story where you talk about how immigrants are basically like the backbone of the restaurant industry, and the documented workers are the backbone of the industry. And so it makes even less sense that they're not being celebrated as part of part of the culture
and part of the narrative. Like there's no reason why they shouldn't also be part of the narrative. It's a less flashy story maybe, and a less flashy headline, but it's an important story. It's an important headline.
What were some of the like challenges that came with being an undocumented restaurant worker?
Oh man, fear, a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety about being discovered and being taken and taken advantage of. And like it came with a lot of anxiety, and I never felt like I could stay somewhere for too long, because I just, there was no trust, or there was a lot of anxiety that came with it, essentially.
I'm trying to think of the right way to ask this, because I feel like as consumers and as, you know, diners, and a lot of people listening, you know, go out to eat quite a bit. What can consumers do to help or to, like, even be aware of it or learn more?
That's a tough question. Know who's behind there making your food. Right. You know, at the core of it, like, we're human beings. Like, just relate to people on a human level. Like, what would you want if someone came to your place and ate there? Would you just want them to ignore you? Or would you want to be spoken to, or, you know, like, just get to know who's making your food. Yeah.
And that's why, this is full circle, that's why your dinner series is so awesome.
Thank you.
Because it's in this completely personal space. Your husband's making drinks.
Yeah, he's a bartender. He's so great at it.
And it's you and Yemi and occasionally a helper.
Yeah,
you know, passing out plates. And when I went, your brother was in town.
he opens the door for guests. Yeah, it's a very like intimate thing. It involves my whole family and like the people who are close to me. Sometimes my parents are there, and my mom's in the kitchen with us. So, yeah, I joke around that I don't really want to work in restaurants anymore, but I run a restaurant one day a week. But it's the kind of restaurant that I would want to go to. You know, it's like I would want it to be personal and engaging, and I would want to have conversations with the guest. And, you know, a lot of times the kitchen's so removed from the dining space that you have, like, no access to the people back there actually making your food. And that's a really interesting concept to me. Like, I want to be as involved in the front of the house, because I want to know who's coming in, you know, what are they about? Like, why are they here? Mm-hmm. And so that's, I run a restaurant one day a month in my home.
A great restaurant.
Thank at that.
So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Hungry Society.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
I'm Souther Teague of Amoria Margo and a co-host of The Speakeasy right here on Heritage Radio Network. You know, my favorite thing to do every week is to come here and be on the show. I have lots of jobs. I am a very busy person. And I do this because I love it. I get to sit down and talk to all my heroes for about an hour every week. It's incredible. And I hope that you enjoy it, making a great effort to share with you. And we'd like you to share back with us. It's our summer fundraiser, and we'd love for you to donate at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. You can click on the beating heart, and you can even choose shows that you'd like to donate to specifically. And you can also choose a recurring monthly gift. And for all that, we'd be greatly appreciative. Thank you so much.
All right, so we're back with more A Hungry Society. And just quickly, I wanted to reiterate what Souther Teague said, and we're doing our summer fun drive. And, you know, I really want to encourage you all to become members. You can go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to be a member, and there's all sorts of cool member gifts like an HRN pin, a beer koozie, a t-shirt, a cheese board, or you could even come to the studio and do a tour and check out Roberta. So head to the website, that's heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and check it out. So we're still here with Yuande sitting here. And the Roberta's crowd is like rowdy today. We were talking about that during the break.
I think it's a football match, right? The World Cup.
Right. The World Cup is on. Right. So it's not just the pizza. That's making people crazy.
There's a reason.
Right. There's another reason. So do you have any dining memories growing up?
Dining memories? I do. I was actually thinking about this earlier. So my mom, in her very scientist fashion, had a meal plan for us. So we had a menu, a daily menu. And so... It's like, it was like Monday we ate this, Tuesday we ate this. So my dining experiences growing up were around a dinner table. Like we always ate dinner together, very formal, with like the table was set, fork, knives, plates, glasses. Actually kind of how I set the table now at my dinners, which is hilarious. But the most fun memory I have is that my parents brought back from Germany with them this old cowbell. This old little cowbell that we had like hanging in the kitchen. And so when dinner was ready, my mom would ring that bell. And wherever we were in the house or like outside, we would like know that it was time for dinner. And so we would come in and like wash up if we had to and sit at the table. But yeah, we always had dinner together as a family. It was kind of a time to catch up on our daily.
Your mom sounds so fascinating. Like between the like meal planning.
I wish I was that organized now, you know, like to have like a menu every day like that.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
And then the cowbell. Like that's what happened if you missed the cowbell and you just
I don't know that we ever missed it.
I guess it would be pretty hard.
It was like, you know, it wasn't like a huge house. So it would be hard to miss it.
But, did you go out to eat a lot or ever?
We did occasionally. Not a lot. We ate mostly, like we didn't really have like a dining out culture. But we did occasionally. I do remember like my first time having Lebanese food in Lagos. And I like my mind was like blown. You know, I was like, what is hummus? Like, what are the people doing in the kitchen? Like, how are they making this? Like, how are they creating this? What are they like, what's the magic that they're doing, you know? And like the flatbreads, like I just wanted to wrap myself in like the little flatbreads. There were like very specific times that we did go out, but not often.
Do you have like beyond the Lebanese food, do you have like a specific like family dining out memory?
I think the Lebanese food would have to be it. There was another experience where we had Chinese food for the first time, because Chinese restaurants were pretty popular when I was growing up in Lagos. But and I think they still are. But yeah, I don't think that it was as foreign to me as like the Lebanese food, because there's like rice, there's we eat a lot of rice in Nigeria as well. Mm. And so like I could see the similarities and why we were like going there. But I think the Lebanese food experience was just like mind blown.
That must have been, yeah, I do wish that like I could go back in that kitchen and see how they were making food. And like I think so also in your dinner series, like the whole idea is like being from somewhere else and like adapting your food to where mm-hmm. you are now and migration and all that. And just, I think that's so fascinating and true of like adapting things to fit where you are now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I think it's part of the immigrant experience. You know, you can't always get the exact ingredient that you had in the country where you're from. So, you know, instead of using like the big tuber yam, I would use sweet potatoes sometimes because it's like starchy, it's got the similar texture. So yeah, there is that process of adapting, and which is fascinating to me just as a recipe developer. It's like, okay, like how far can I stretch this ingredient
right
in this direction, you know, and let's see where it goes.
So. Yeah. Do you have a favorite restaurant at the moment?
A favorite restaurant? Maybe a favorite cuisine.
Okay.
I'm really into Nigerian food right now.
Is that fair, though?
I think it is, because for so long I didn't really explore it. So it's like I would drive anywhere. If there's a good Nigerian restaurant, like I am going there, you know.
What's the furthest you've driven to go to a Nigerian restaurant?
Utah.
Oh my god, wow.
So last summer I took a road trip with my husband and we drove across the country specifically looking for Nigerian/West African restaurants, and that's, so Utah was the farthest we got.
That's amazing. Yeah. Where is that book?
Where is that?
Yeah, I need to read that. It sounds really good.
It's in my head right now, but it's coming.
Awesome. Yeah. Do you have any restaurants that you go to like over and over again in the city?
Oh man. So we used to go to this restaurant called Rye. It was in Williamsburg. It just recently closed, which I'm so sad about because they just had amazing food. And I felt like it was a little slice of like old Williamsburg before it became like the, you know, the mega city it is now. But yeah, the food there was really good. It was just like kind of like American bistro-ish type food with like French influences. They had this like really amazing cassoulet that was amazing in like the winter. But it's closed now, so I'm currently looking.
The position's open.
Yeah, the position's open for like a new favorite restaurant.
So that was your favorite. Can you talk about one of the worst dining experiences you've ever had?
I have been trying to think about this question, and I blocked it out my memory.
That's very fortunate.
But like, I can't really think of like a terrible dining experience.
Wow, that's very lucky.
I can't really think of one. I can think of like something that I would assume to be a bad, you know, like I could make up one, but you know, like maybe if I went to a restaurant and like
was there one that was like disappointing that you were like super excited for and then you're just like
but you know, okay. What also, I don't go out to eat a lot. I like cook at home a lot. So that could be part of it, but yeah, like I haven't had an experience where it's like, oh my god, I could never eat there or I could never go there. Yeah, I can't think of one.
Wow, that's amazing. You were the first guest.
Really?
To not have a worst dining experience.
Yeah, like I don't have a worst dining experience.
That's amazing. I need to go out to eat with you because I feel like I have like quite a few.
And, you know, I think I, and not to say that this is why, but I'm very picky when it comes to picking a place to eat.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So it's like I'm very picky.
Are there things that, like, you, if you see it on a website or a menu, or, like, what are your I'm not going there sort of things that make you picky about restaurants?
Fusion cuisine.
As a whole, just X, not doing it.
Well, yeah, like, yeah, that it doesn't appeal to me, like, the word fusion in a cuisine.
That's fair.
Doesn't really appeal to me. Yeah, like I like spicy food, so I tend to veer more towards restaurants that serve that kind of food.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I can't think of a worse dining experience.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, looking at the dining culture of New York as a whole, kind of, what do you make of it? And are there certain things that you wish you could change or be different?
Yeah, on so many levels. I think, again, the restaurants that are highlighted are very specific restaurants. I think that the full story of the restaurant and how it operates and how it's able to be successful, you don't get to hear that story. So I would like for that to change. You know, I think that it's important to tell not just slices of a story. Like, you should tell the full story. And be more inclusive in your coverage of that story, because a restaurant requires teamwork, and who else is running things? Who else is making sure that things operate in a fashion that's, like, convenient for everyone? I think also the idea of farm to table, I love the idea of farm to table. I love that people are into it, but I think that there's a certain inaccessibility that comes with that idea, and I don't think that's necessarily true. Like, I don't think farm to table needs to be this inaccessible thing. I think that people should know where their food comes from. Like, that should be part of the story that's told, and it shouldn't be something that you have to pay $1,000 to get a good meal. You know, like, it should be everyday life. Like, food is a way of life, and so adding a hefty price tag to it makes it inaccessible to a lot of people. So why tell that story that, you know, farm to table? It's like the most basic thing, just knowing right. Where your food comes from. It's like, where's the rest of a chicken, you know?
Right.
So and this is also just influenced by my travels. You know, seeing the way my parents, like, know exactly what they're growing in their garden. And I'm not saying that everybody should have a garden, because I know that's not possible, but I think farmers, like, get to know farmers in your neighborhood, get to know farmers in your area. Yeah, it should be something that's accessible to everybody. Mm-hmm. And so that I would love to see that change.
To quote Yemi, vegetables should not be bougie.
Yeah.
Vegetables are for everybody.
For everybody.
And somehow, like, you know, through marketing or whatever, organic vegetables and, like, farm to table has become, like, this kind of status symbol.
Symbol, yeah. Or, like, the farmer's market.
Right.
You know, is now a status symbol. But, like,
it should be for everybody.
It should be for everybody. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, make it more accessible.
So, Iwande, this is the last question.
Last question.
I know, I can't believe this, like, flew by.
I know, it's like...
If you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be, and who's invited?
Wow. I don't think it would be in a restaurant. I think it would be in my home. Yeah, I think that it would be either a potluck, or, because I like cooking with people, it would be, like, come over and, like, let's make food together and let's enjoy this last meal. But it would be a collective experience like that. And I don't know that restaurants really lend themselves to that experience. And so I wouldn't want it to be in a restaurant. I would want it to be at home. Yeah.
Who's invited?
Oh, my God. The people closest to me, friends, mm-hmm. family. You're invited.
Thank you.
But, yeah, like, the people closest to me, the people that I cherish and want to spend time with.
Anybody from like history, living or dead, that you admire that you'd want to like come through in this imaginary situation?
Okay. I've been really into researching my ancestors and like their stories, and so I would want them to be there. Like I would want my grandmothers to be there, and like I've been really getting into like African traditional history, like specifically Yoruba traditional stories and like traditional history, and so like there would be like Marami would be there because she's like such a powerful person in Yoruba culture. But yeah, I would love some of my ancestors to be there.
Any specific food or drink that would have to be on the table?
Spicy food. There would have to be like a vat of chili oil that I can put on everything.
Douse everything in chili oil.
Yes. Like I want to feel the heat. I want to feel the fire. So yeah.
That's amazing. Well, I mean, this could go on
forever. Yeah. I know.
We could just keep going.
Rice would have to be there. Yes. I could eat rice every day.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where can listeners find out more about your dinner series, your work?
On my website, it's yawandekamalafe.com. Mm-hmm. That's everything is up there. So.
Yes, and like, please, if you're in the city and there's a dinner coming up, you should absolutely go. It's a great time. I've been telling everyone about this dinner. So, yeah, thank you so much for being here.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to A Hungry Society. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.